And we got an Eastwood. Hello, sir.
Hello. Go ahead. Make my news.
All right. Let's see if I can get this clip to work here.
Hey, Vinny, this is Bill. How you doing?
Hi, Bill. I don't know who you are.
I don't know who you are, really. I'm kidding. I know exactly who you are. I thought you were like a 45-year-old man when I first heard your voice.
Really?
You got a great radio voice, man. You got pipes, as they say.
I got the pipes. Hey, I do have pipes.
In America, they always say, got great pipes on them, you know?
Yeah. Do they always say that, Bill?
In radio, he's got great pipes.
So in New Zealand, we usually use that to describe somebody who consumes vast quantities of marijuana.
Really?
You got great pipes, man. You got great pipes.
Hey, guys, take 48 seconds and watch this clip I just threw in, because today is episode 33 of Always Record.
Really?
Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up. I was just talking.
No, that's what we were just saying, how you can't make this stuff up. And it's like, actually, you can, but we aren't. Let's... so this is episode 33 of the old Batman TV show.
No shit.
Everyone got that?
Yeah, I don't need to keep watching it when it gets all weird, right?
Oh, I don't... Oh, is this... Did this get all weird?
No, they repeat it. It's all like, I founded Skull and Bones.
Oh.
Gets all...
Sorry, I just grabbed the first one I saw.
Right, but that's there.
Has anybody else noticed, if you're looking for the number 33, you see it literally everywhere? Like... I think last night my friend bought a new Spacey's machine. You know, you got all those old arcade games and stuff like that, and we're playing it. And we got kind of unlimited credit, so it's just however many times you press the button or whatever. So you just click it, and it just came up 33. And I don't know. I think it happened maybe 5 or 6 times yesterday alone that I saw the number 33. You know, like I had 33 Skype messages. 33 emails come in the day. You know, I don't know, 33 Facebook friends ads or something. I don't know. It just happens all the time. It's crazy. And you see it in the movies as well. Have you ever seen the movie Bolt? You know, little digital movie with the dog that's got superpowers, kind of thing. He's chucking this this explosive frisbee or something, and it gets chucked towards the camera. And it's on a timer, so it's like it's counting down, you know, da, 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 da. And as it almost hits the camera, it hits the 33-second mark, and then shoots away again. It's like, I don't know if it means anything, or if I'm just seeing something that's not there, or if I'm just starting to go crazy, or maybe. It's all there. It's all there for a purpose, and I'm just happened to be picking up on it because I'm looking for it.
So, Vinny, before you came on, we were discussing in the new Batman how before the big explosion in the Coliseum or the stadium, it zooms in on this window and it shows you 322 below the man in the window, which is, as we know, the Skull and Bones number, which is just, because so that's a sink. You know, you have his grandfather found Skull of Bones in the story, and then here you have 322 below the window, really emphasized.
Yeah. Well, wait. So let's just back up a second. So ultimately, what we have to figure out, I feel like our job is to use some discernment and say, what is a synchronicity and what is not? By the way, Vinny, you were confused last time. This is the official show. Everyone, welcome Vincent Eastwood of the Vinny Eastwood Show. Yay. Awesome having you, buddy. But we're just going to dive right into this because this is ultimately what we're trying to figure out. Is that so that you have one community that's saying this is all synchronicity and another community that's saying this is all conspiracy. This is planted. There's someone planted this in there. Now, I think it's very possible with a number like 322, that could be Nolan with doing a little wink and a nod to something. That's very, very possible. I'm not taking position on it one way or the other, but it seems likely that's, if you're going to zoom in on a number like that, you probably have some idea of what you're referencing. It's possible that it's a total coincidence. As we know, we didn't plan for this to be episode 33, and it's funny that you've been seeing 33 all day yesterday. I don't think 33... The problem is, we're just using that as an example, is that you see in certain conspiracy circles, every time there's a number 33, someone goes, this is proof of a Masonic conspiracy. Whereas we know from a personal synchronicity level that the Masons didn't make sure you got 33 messages in your email yesterday. They didn't make sure that you saw the number 33 on your way to, you know, take a shit or something.
Oh, yeah. I just happen to look at my clock when it's 33 minutes past the hour or 33 seconds past the minute and stuff like that. I just happen to be doing it. I remember one time I was going to bed. I normally sometimes... if I've got like lots of videos to do, I'll leave one processing overnight, so it counts down certain minutes. And on my way to bed, there's the washing machine that counts down, you know, a certain amount of minutes. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just check how many minutes my video's got to process. 33 minutes, okay. And then I was walking back to bed, past the washing machine. How many minutes is it until my washing is finished? 33 minutes. And, you know. It's like, are you fucking with me?
So this is my point, though, because when you feel that, are you fucking with me? That experience, I think, is what we are collectively feeling on a grand scale. The fact that this Sandy Hook image in Batman has become such a popular thing to dissect, and everyone's looking at this as a proof of some sort of conspiracy. And what I'm saying is that within the synchromystic circles, this isn't even that big a deal. I see weirder stuff than this on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. The fact is, if someone pointed this out to me as a synchronicity, I'd chuckle and move on with my life. I don't see it as that big a deal. However, what this does tell me is that on a mass scale, as more of these things are noticed, are people ready for them? If they're going to say, are you fucking with me? If that's the response to seeing a number 33 or seeing the word Sandy Hook in one frame of a movie, if this is the reaction, are people ready for the high weirdness that comes with these type of research?
Well, here's another thing. I watch a lot of movies. It's obscene the amount of movies that I watch, from a day-to-day basis. I just consuming. And there are things that they happen so often that you begin to be suspicious that it's even possible that it's coincidence. Like, for example, when was the last time you were walking around and you saw a black and white tiled Masonic floor? Just in your day-to-day existence. And I haven't seen one in years. In fact, the last time I saw a black and white tiled floor is when I was in the largest Masonic lodge in New Zealand. Well, second largest, sorry. And the thing is, when I'm watching films, it doesn't matter whether they're from Lionsgate Productions or... 20th Century Fox or Warner Brothers or Paramount or Columbia or any number of film studios, I'm always looking for black and white tiled floors. And sure enough, there they are. In every single movie that I watch, or almost every single movie, it's actually very rare for me to watch a film and not notice a black and white tiled Masonic floor. Now, is it coincidence that every single film that's made by every single movie company in somewhere has a black and white tiled Masonic floor? Are they that popular? Is every single director that obsessed with making sure that there's a bit of a set in every single film that has something like that? It's beyond a joke. And I think is, when you want to prove something conclusively, You can't, especially with that. But there are things that are a hell of a lot more suspicious, like a film called Street Kings with Keanu Reeves. And the premise of this film is that there's these two cops who are hired cop killers. And Keanu Reeves is trying to find out who these people are. And he goes to their apartment, and they're upstairs. As he's walking up the stairs, right in the middle of the frame, there's many, many of these lampshades, and they're all identical lampshades throughout the apartment and going up the stairwells as well. And on one of those lampshades, only one of them, but it's right as he's ascending the staircase, about to find out who these cop killers are, there is a Masonic all-seeing eye on top of a pyramid done in black magic marker on the lampshade as they're ascending the staircase directly in the center of the frame. There is no possibility that that wasn't deliberately put in there, because nobody who is a filmmaker has things in their frame that are that obvious by accident, particularly in the center of the frame. It has been put there deliberately. Who directed it? I can't remember. You know, why exactly are they putting it in there? Well, my friend Freighter X, who is a member of 9 secret societies, has told me that it's actually specific that they have indeed infiltrated Hollywood in order to what he called influence society by putting and inserting Masonic symbolism into the culture in order to kind of take control of it, sort of thing. I'm not sure what his research and things like that is, but it's just, if you want to get paranoid, there's more than enough things out there to be paranoid about. See, me personally, I'll just, you know, see stuff like that and just go, eh. And it's not proof, you know. Proof is like an admission. So if somebody says, I admit that I put that Masonic all-seeing eye and pyramid in that film, that for me qualifies as proof. The fact that I see it, and nothing's really talked about it in any way, shape, or form. You know, you listen to the DVD commentary, and that scene comes and goes, and the director doesn't mention anything about it or whatever. You just don't know. And if you don't know, in my opinion, you really shouldn't care, because so many people waste their lives, literally waste their entire existence, fuddling around with all these little details, thinking that they mean something, and they instead of actually having real meaning and purpose to their own lives.
Sure, yeah. And I think the other thing that you have to realize is that these symbols are so universal that it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an affiliation to Masonry. On the first volume of the Sync book, Justin put, so you know there are 33 vertebrae in the human spine, right? So this number is not just, you know, a Masonic number. This is a human number. So on the spine of the first volume of the Sync book, Justin put 33 little dashes going up it to say this is the spine of the book. And I'm going to, you know, make a reference to the human spine and just sort of playing with it. Now, that's, of course, a knowing little jab at the people who are looking for something, but it's also a legitimate reference to something that, hey, I think this is interesting. So, you know, what we have to realize is with artists, you might be influenced by something you see going down the street. I might pass, I might hear a conversation at a party and go, oh, that's really interesting the way that those two people interacted, and I might insert that into a script. Or I might learn something about an esoteric school and say, that's a really fascinating thing. Let me put a detail from that. That doesn't mean that I hold some sort of allegiance to that esoteric school. It doesn't mean I'm a member of that society. It doesn't mean I have some grand agenda. So we have to realize, and I'm speaking first person, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing that, but I'm saying, whoever is doing that, that doesn't necessarily mean some sort of affiliation. And even if it does, like if I see someone in a movie, someone walking around with a crucifix, I don't get freaked out. Oh my God, they're part of some sort of Catholic conspiracy or Christian conspiracy to promote Christianity in movies. You know, if I see a character wearing a yarmulke, we don't go, oh, look, there. Well, I guess there are some people who freak out. Look, it's the Jews who run Hollywood. But I think anyone with some common sense doesn't freak out about that. I'm saying is, if you saw a character with a religious affiliation in a movie, you don't automatically assume that that director or that writer or that prop master or anybody is trying to shove something down your throat. They might be using that as an archetype or some sort of influence, obviously, but that doesn't mean that they themselves belong to that group or revere that group or that god. You know, I love when all these people freak out about the Luciferians. Like, you don't even know who Lucifer is. You can't really. And why aren't why aren't you freaking out about the quote unquote Christian conspiracy in movies? Why aren't you freaking out about the quote unquote Islamic conspiracy in movies? Why aren't you freaking out about any of these things? To see someone, even if someone said, I'm a 33rd degree Mason and I directed Star Wars. And is that any different than some guy saying, I'm a practicing Catholic and I directed, Blade Runner, whatever. Does that matter?
Well, it depends. It depends, because I've spoken to James Wright, who was the servant to the Lodge of 33rd Degree in Dallas, Texas. And every single day, he was propositioned by these married 33rd degree Masons for sex, you know? And his conclusion is that you cannot, and I think Frater X concurs with him on this, and I've spoken to a number of occult researchers, and they seem to have all been part of these orders, and they literally know what they're talking about, and they say it is not possible for you to become a ranking Freemason of the 33rd degree without either being an evil person or being open to demon possession of some description. And that's from the mouths of people who are literally in that circle. This is something that is known within those circles. Whereas the rest of us, we're on the outside. We don't know. We haven't been there. We haven't done that. Kind of like, you don't understand what it's like to be a Marine unless you've been a Marine.
Okay, but I guess what I don't get is that people automatically assume there's some validity to that. Talk about demonic possession. I don't even know, I have not seen conclusive evidence that I believe that demons exist and demonic possession exists. So, let's deal with that first.
We're talking about belief as well.
Sure.
Because they've got these really crazy belief structures in these esoteric
My point is, so does every religion. If we freaked out because some director of a movie, I'm going to use the Christian example because that's the most mainstream acceptable religion, is to say, if we found out some guy was a Christian movie director, we wouldn't freak out that he believes in some being who came from sky and died and then comes back from the dead and all this sort of stuff. We could tear that apart and go, look how weird that is. Or the fact that many Christians talk about being filled with the Spirit of Jesus. You have to open up your heart and let the Spirit of Jesus into your heart. Well, isn't that spirit possession? So we're not, on a mass scale, we're not freaking out that someone's saying, oh, these people have this crazy belief in spirit possession. They want you to be open to spirit possession. To me, that's just as strange as someone saying, Aleister Crowley saying, he took on the spirit of Ra. I don't really see a distinction between him saying he opened himself up to the spirit of Ra and some Christian housewife saying they opened themselves up to the spirit of Jesus. That's still spirit possession, whatever, however you want to label it. And if and that's their belief, is that that's okay and that's actually the ideal. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do we label which spirits are good spirits and which spirits are bad spirits seems to come prepackaged with that belief system.
It depends. If you're a 33rd degree Freemason, according to James Wright, you're propositioning people for sex all the time. And if you go against them, they stalk you, try to kill you. And there's much documented evidence of that. Mm. If you're a Christian who's got the spirit of Jesus, you help out in your community and you do childcare and bake sales and stuff like that. that, as opposed to
sacrifice. Right, but they're not.
You know, like you bake cookies for the kids as opposed to sacrificing them, kind of thing. That's how you know whether or not one's good or evil.
You're making a distinction, though. You're making a distinction between the Christians who are community Christians who are on that level. I mean, there's
we're talking about two extremes. Yeah, yeah.
That side of masonry.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also you're speaking of the infiltration of Hollywood. I mean, a lot of those people were the founders of Hollywood who were high up Masons. But then at the same time, you look at Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robinson from the late 1700s. He talks about the infiltration of Masonry itself by the Illuminati. And have you heard of this?
The infiltration of Freemasonry is actually something that Fredericks is writing a book about as we speak. It's called The Secret War Inside Freemasonry.
I've heard that book is going to come out through Sync Book Press, actually. That's what I hear.
And
they do great work, I hear.
Well, see, I mean, when you're talking to somebody who's literally like a master of nine different esoteric orders, you know, you're talking about someone with knowledge far beyond any of our scope, because he has access to all of these libraries with dusty tomes like in Lord of the Rings and stuff like that, sitting down there reading away via candlelight with one of those little things, and it's just kind of like it's actually quite funny and quite spooky at the same time, that if Freemasonry used to be about men expanding other men, okay, being in contact with mentors and these sorts of things, and now it's been taken over by this other Masonic order called the Scottish Rite, which actually in many ways doesn't equate to almost any real form of Freemasonry as it was. And instead now, whenever anybody wants to talk about Freemasonry or whatever, who are the people that come on as the commentators? Who are the people who the public see on the History Channel as the ones who are Freemasons? It's always the Scottish Rite, the 33rd to 32nd degree or something like that. You know, the York Rite doesn't seem to be known about, and people don't know about all of these different orders. And in New Zealand, this country is basically founded 100% by Freemasonry. Every single town and city, first thing you see when you come into pretty much any New Zealand town or city is a sign with a Freemason symbol saying indicating that there's a lodge nearby with some kind of spire. And, you know, of course, you know they put that there, and in the center of most towns as well, there's some kind of Masonic pillar. In the centre of Auckland City, there's a hill called One Tree Hill. It used to have a tree on it, but some dude cut it down. And next to the tree, there's this, Masonic pillar. And it's on a block of land that is owned by the New Zealand Freemasons that is 330 acres. So 33. You know, There's certain things that are obvious, and other things that are esoteric and maybe coincidental that you don't know, and I think, you know, the esoteric is all about accepting possibility rather than jumping to conclusions and saying that it's a fact.
Well, morals and dogma, and all through the whole thing, everything it's mostly synchronicity. So go through that book, connects to this, connects to this, connects to this, and extrapolate information from how they connect. I have my Morals and Dogma open right here, and I love how on the first page, it says, esoteric book for Scottish Rite use only, to be returned upon withdrawal or death of recipient. And that's the newest ones that you'll find don't actually have that anymore, which I find interesting. You can find a copy of this book on eBay at this point. I think it's really noteworthy that it's not up until, 10 years ago that it's available to general people. Like, I can hold a copy of my hand, never having participated at all in Masonry, though I have lots of friends who have done quite a bit of that. But I think that there's something to be said for the information age in which we live, the fact that we can just look this stuff up. And for the longest time, I mean, even with the Bible, I mean, like, people weren't able to have access to the fucking Bible until relatively recently as well, when you look at the scope of things, you know? And so literacy is one thing, but then the question is so readily accessible is something else. But this is all stated, these synchronicities are stated as intentionalized facts throughout Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which is not taking the position of no position. It's a very particular thing that they're expressing, and they emphasize that.
Well, as far as like secrets, I think today it's all come down through history, and it's best expressed in something like the Coca-Cola Corporation, where Coca-Cola had a secret formula that, you know, was mythologized, that there's this formula, only four people know what it is, and they have it locked up in safes, in vaults, and, you know, it would all come tumbling down if that formula was, the public had access to that, that they could then go out and make their own Coca-Cola. I think all of this stuff needs to be seen through the lens of Crowley's chapter, Onion Peelings, that there's just layers and layers and layers, and that there are layers to 33 degree Masons. There's probably, you know, asshounds out there that got into it for the sex, and they got their card and they carried around to all the lodges, doing what they do. But, you know, they might serve a purpose for some other layer that's either trying to, you know, take advantage of them, or some layer that's inside, you know, above. And, you know, to try to make this a linear explanation is just to not get the central tenet of all of this area of research. All of this shit plays off another level. It's all relative. And it's how can you exploit it for power? And I think that you just boil it down there. Are you doing it for the good of the common man? Are you doing it for the good of yourself? And you can almost essentially boil it all down, all, you know, white magic or black magic, into that kind of domain. And so, I mean, I love Frederick's. I do. Don't get me wrong. I think he speaks, he backs up what he says. He's, but I mean, when I hear nine secret societies, I mean, no offense to him, but that just, it sounds kind of funny to me.
Well, nine different esoteric orders. Yeah, exactly. And I've got the whole conclusion that the reason Freight is a part of so many of these different secret orders is because he's got such a massive thirst for knowledge. Like, the amount of books that he consumes on a daily, weekly basis, you know, would blow the minds of most illiterate Americans and New Zealanders. But and he's just told me the stories of how he loves to go into these archives of these lodges everywhere, and nobody ever goes down to these archives, right? There's just thousands and thousands upon books down there that none of the Masons in the lodge have looked at in 100+ years, kind of thing, you know, like old dusty.
Right, because no one cares anymore.
Nobody cares.
Right. That's why I think that's part of the proof of, I think, the position that these Masons aren't part of some grand occult mystery, is they've actually forgotten their mystery school teachings. Many of them are interested in the business contacts. How can I get more business for my plumbing company? Oh, I become a Mason.
How can I get away from my wife a couple of nights a week?
Right, something like that. So, you know, and then maybe you do the bake sale, maybe you do what, you know, some local charity work or something. But if you're not going down into the basement and reading the book, then you're not, you don't even know that there is an occult something or other. You know, I know. Go ahead.
The Freemasons, for me, and I could be completely wrong about this, were master builders, just quite simply. So they didn't need to rely upon any outside agency to construct houses. So when we went from nomadic cultures to agricultural cultures, you needed to have buildings to live in, and especially if you wanted to expand into territories where weather conditions made it impossible to live in. So you had a sort of union of builders that had strength in numbers, that these fringe people who had knowledge, that kept getting destroyed by vandals and invaders and rapers and pillagers, they said, we need to keep this knowledge alive. So they found a way to integrate themselves into the Freemasonic Corporation, if you will, because they had numbers, they had structures, they had food to survive, you know, droughts, famines, whatnot. They had armies to protect themselves from these tribal groups that lived out on the outskirts of agricultural society. And they just said the only place for Freemasonry is a hard drive, and you could preserve information within it. And it's almost like a virus that saw, or a parasite that saw a place to protect itself so it could transmit knowledge down history. And that's what all this stuff is. You can build a library, but the library can be burned. And then how do the people who don't know the sum total of that knowledge begin to rebuild a library? They said, fuck this. We can't think about ourselves. We need to find a way to transmit knowledge down to our spiritual children who might be 5, 6, 7 generations away. And they found places like Freemasonry to do this because you couldn't do it with the church. The church would destroy the information.
Yeah.
Because the church wanted to put the pause button on history. And so that's why you have all this deep, powerful esoteric wisdom in Freemasonry, because it was sort of like the indie scene or the underground scene. It was outside of the church, and they knew that, hey, fuck, you want to use our basement to store some books? That's cool, man. You're a brother, you know? And that's how I think the whole thing worked. That's my interpretation.
My father-in-law is a very deeply religious Christian man, and is also a brilliant engineer. So he has this like really strong scientific mind and also this really strong Christian faith, right? So it's interesting to see how that plays out. It's actually given me a whole new insight into that sort of world. But it's interesting because we were talking one night and we were just like walking. It was late at night and we hooked up with the moon. And he goes, you know, I don't understand how it took people so long to figure out how the moon moves and where it is in space. He's like, it was like, you know, common sense to his like mathematical brain. He's like, it's obviously a sphere. It moves through space. He's like, I don't understand why people for so long couldn't figure this stuff out. And I was like, well, let me explain it to you. You go back to biblical times, and the guy next to you says, I think maybe that moon moves around like this. And you watch everyone around you throw stones at him and beat him to death. And then suddenly you shut the fuck up. And you go, you know what? I'll just keep that thought to myself. Because if you're in an age where you can't say, you know, these are ages where you couldn't dissect human cadavers to study anatomy, so you have to guess, or you have to go into the basement and cut up bodies, and then you're suddenly that creepy black magic guy who's cutting up dead bodies. Well, maybe you just want to understand anatomy, and you're not allowed to do it. So all these things where if you watch the people around you getting stoned to death for even suggesting that things are different, suddenly you shut the hell up. And if you meet someone else who's also like you, you know, you kind of, hey, psst, I'll meet you down the hall next Thursday, and maybe we can talk about that big glowing ball in the sky.
I've always found that funny, and this conversation reminds me of a calendar that I saw on my dad's batch one time, and it has the days, and it also has a fish symbol of varying filled out degrees, like the fishing's going to be so good this day and that day and that day. And I was like, how the hell did they determine, like, in a calendar, like a year in advance, what the fishing's going to be like on a particular day? Did they get some like real old salty sea dog motherfuckers just to sit down there and, you know, I reckon that. What the fuck?
We might know the mating schedule of fish, you know, to some degree of when they, I don't know, culminate or whatever. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, yeah, see, and again, farmers, the point is that we've got so many things out there that appear official, but we don't understand. Official, that's a pun there. And that appear official that we don't even know exactly how they came to that kind of thing. Have you noticed that we don't understand anything around us? Like this, for example. This is a megaphone. I have no fucking idea how this thing works. I could, if you put, like, what was his name? Like Joe Rogan said, you know, you could stick me away in a forest for 1,000 years trying to figure out how to make a cell phone, and I wouldn't be able to do it. Have you noticed how we're so detached from real knowledge these days?
Yes.
All right. And even simplicity. Like I was talking about this with my producer's wife the other day. I said, we don't know anything, okay? We really don't know anything. You have a look at this apple tree here. We don't even know how to define exactly what an impact just a simple apple tree will have. How many fruits will it bear? I don't know. How much nutrition will it actually return to the soil by the result of those fruits that are uneaten, that drop? I don't know. How many birds nest on that tree? I don't know. We don't understand anything, even down to the minutiae, about anything really. And it's made me really, really humble, and my conclusion is I really don't know anything, and very few people really do know anything about anything. Think it's part of our human society that we try to make sense of these things because we're not comfortable with being uninformed fools.
Oh, yeah. And I think this is why the temptation's there to take a hard-line position, is to feel like you know something, because it's really scary sometimes to know how little you know. You know, the exact what you're talking about, this idea of if you spent 1,000 years in a forest, could you come with a cell phone? No. And even if you could, you wouldn't know that it worked. Let's say you hit on the right combination of cell phone, you wouldn't know if it worked if there was no cell phone tower anymore, right? So maybe you built it, but it doesn't work. So you have no idea that it works. I was thinking about this, like the idea of like this sort of, whether it be ancient aliens or some sort of really advanced society from 1 billion years ago or, you know, whatever, just sort of entertaining these thoughts. And I was like, just look at how we have it, where we used to have cassette tapes and now, you know, we had like all our media was on something physical. And now more and more we go to a digital media and even like things like cloud computing. So it's basically traps out there floating in some digital cloud, or maybe it's on a hard drive somewhere, or maybe it's whatever. Now, let's say you take our current society, you know, drop an atomic bomb or an ice age or something on it, or, you know, destroy this, and then people are trying to rebuild their cell phones. How would there be enough people that would remember how to do it, how to use it? Maybe the infrastructure is not there anymore. And then maybe you don't even have the evidence that it existed. This is just, bear in mind, just entertaining ideas. But something like, if you've gotten rid of all your, you know, tangible, like, here's my hard drive. Oh, I don't need a hard drive anymore. Now it's on a flash drive. Now it's on this little microchip. Now it's on some, you know, digital newosphere, essentially. Once those things are gone, what evidence do you have to come back? And then even if you did, again, like I give the cell phone example, how do you even know if it works? So maybe we could have had iPhones 1 billion years ago, but if you had an iPhone 1 billion years ago, but no more cell phone towers, for all intents and purposes, you have a crappy piece of plastic nothing.
Yeah, well, and some would argue that an iPhone is a crappy piece of plastic nothing in and of
itself. I don't have one. I don't have one.
Oh, yeah.
For your next birthday, Alan, I'm getting you an iPhone. Phenomenal.
Have you noticed how people they choose to reject certain information because they just don't like it, they're uncomfortable with it or whatever. They refuse to look into it or listen to anybody who spouts about it. Like I had a Christian guy on my show yesterday, and we talked about Alex Jones for an hour, and then we talked about aliens and demonology for the second hour. You know, me, I don't know about you guys, but I just like to put my finger in as many pies as possible. Just I like the flavors. One of my listeners in the chat room says, Vinny, why are you even entertaining this guy? And I was like, it is a show, isn't it? Isn't entertaining people the name of the game?
I think even just for our own personal education, like I know, even doing these sync books, you know, or now doing these radio shows, I have people on who I disagree with, but I want to, again, not entertain, your pun is well appreciated, but the idea of I want to consider their thoughts. Even if I disagree with them, all the more reason that I should at least consider their position and figure out, well, does that make sense? Do they have a convincing argument? And is there something there that maybe, even if I only agree with 5% of it, maybe I've learned something? I think this is what we need to be doing is, you know, that crazy guy spouting on the corner, let's listen to him for a few minutes, figure out if there's something there. And the, you know, scientist who works for CNN, we might say, we don't want to just completely throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, he got a job for a government agency, he's obviously full of shit. Well, maybe he's not. Maybe he came across something that's valuable, but he's working for something that's part of the control system. Like, let's at least entertain different pieces of information, and this is where the onus is on us to, you know, try and distinguish, again, what's synchronicity, what's conspiracy, what's intentional, what's unintentional, what is valuable, what's not. What information can we disregard? What information should we carry that has some sort of value to us? Maybe we should learn how to build megaphones. Maybe, you know, maybe that's more important than figuring out, you know, what Batman's grandfather was doing in a TV show. yeah, I mean, these are like, we should be trying to educate ourselves as much as possible.
Uncomfortable. I think people tend to get uncomfortable with something not taking either position or just the energetic of being open to things. Like, I don't know, it's like with the masonry thing, it just seems like it's so much easier to call it insidious or to say that these people have had nothing but the best intentions for humanity forever and that they're the keepers of the light or this or that, and not the idea that you know, the idea that within these groups, there's so many people wanting a different outcome and want it. I don't think these people are all in agreement. That's absurd. That feels to me absurd to assume that these people are all on the same.
And we could probably say the same
thing, you know,
most things
the same for like the CIA, right? Like not sure. Everyone in the CIA has the same agenda. I'm not trying to give a free pass to the CIA. I'm just saying,
oh, it's just my favorite. One of my favorite words of all time is compartmentalization. You know, I mean, look at it this way.
Sure.
To say that somebody who works in the CIA as an agent knows everything that the CIA is doing is saying that a person who's a clerk at Macca's who just got employed is somehow knows exactly what's on the CEO's mind and could do his job for somehow if he died tomorrow. No. Everybody got different roles, different parts to play, and I can guarantee any organization that I've ever worked for, nobody on the front ground floor or whatever has any fracking clue what the founder of the company or the current CEO of the company is thinking or doing. Not a clue. Okay, they've got these training protocols. You can imagine what they train people at Macca's with. We've served over a billion people. We want to get people something that's fast and yummy and da, 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 and all these positive things. They don't tell them there's about 1,000 cows per beef patty. They don't tell them the cheese is one chemical compound away from polyurethane. They don't tell, you know, they don't tell them any of these things. And I doubt that they even tell the CEO this, you know. There'll be certain people within the organization that may know that or may know that, right, or whatever. But connecting the dots, on the other hand, is an entirely different story. Somebody being part of an organization and fulfilling a role is completely different from somebody being part of an organization and understanding how their role fits in and plays out with the entirety of the organization. Two very different things.
Right. They can be a useful idiot, right?
I think most people are useful idiots.
In fact, no,
I rephrase. I think most people are useless idiots.
that's what I was thinking, yeah.
Well, useful to somebody else's plan. See, that's the thing, is that there's so much pride that goes into any position up the whole ladder. At every rung, somebody has pride in their job. I've known people who are proud of the shittiest jobs imaginable, yet because they gain a certain identity from their role, they're also the energetic of people feeling like they must be in the know if they've been given this title. So all the whole way up, like you say CEOs, I totally, you know, it doesn't seem like just because you got whatever, you know, label you've worked so hard to achieve that you're privy to everything that's going on. Like, to me, this is a thing, like, people talk about the 9/11 agenda. When I see Bush's face in that video of him with the pet goat, he looks fucking clueless and scared. He's like, oh shit, what did they do? Like, it doesn't, he doesn't look like he's some mastermind. He I think he knows a bit, but he's a total useful idiot, as far as I can tell, like, or he was, you know.
Well, I think Bush was just a useless idiot, personally. That's my opinion. But I employment in general, I call it having a slave job. And some of my listeners have caught on with this term, and they, you know, I'll get messages on Skype, like, hey, Vinny, I just got back from my slave job, and they're just such scum. And I got this idea, man, that if you don't really have a choice, if you don't really, really have a choice, then you're a slave. Like, let's say, for example, your choice is arrive, get up earlier than you want to, forcibly with an alarm, get stuck in traffic for an hour, go to a job you hate working with people who are douchebags who don't really give a fuck about you, or you're on the street. You're a slave. You know, you don't there's no real choice there. And the same with government. You know, did you volunteer to pay your taxes? No.
Are dogs and cats slaves?
Huh?
Are dogs and cats and all house pets, are they slaves?
I guess they are. Really?
You just asked that question as my cat jumped up on my lap.
Wonderful.
Your slave cat.
Your cat.
Is my cat what?
Your cat smoking a cigarette? No, I just think this is one of the most difficult arguments if one is to have, I think, a truly open and enlightened conversation about slavery, conspiracy, and all this. There was a story that came on about a woman who opened a business of bringing puppies to nursing homes or to events because they brought such joy to people. Well, you know, you're talking about a life form that is bred to specific, aesthetic degrees to please people, to be products, to be purchased. They are separated from the animality of their species, you know, because they're isolated. They're often kept in environments where they are the only one of their kind, and they are kept for human enjoyment. And people say, well, there's a bond there. And listen, I don't want to step on anyone's toes completely, but you can look at the argument. Why is it acceptable for the common person to breed, purchase, and captivate a creature for their own enjoyment, and then they rail at the government for possible conspiratorial okay, there you go.
Like let's say you own a cat, you own a dog, or you own a slave, right? I don't own Alan. I don't own the guests on American Freedom Radio that I have on or anything like that. I ain't paying them, so there's no slavery implied here with those relationships, because there's no force implied, and again, no ownership. Animals, livestock, are clearly slaves to humanity because we literally purchased them like you would a slave. Even though they have a really nice life. I mean, many slaves had great lives, I'm sure, in the Roman Empire. You know, they'd be sit there, you know, feed a few grapes to Caesar, and it's nice. And they get to live in a nice palace and stuff like that with no balls because they couldn't sleep with the harem or anything like that. And they got had to lift up their kaft hats once upon a time to feel the nice rubbing of giant stones cracking together against their nuts. So slavery itself is just as much a state of being as it is a state of mind. I remember having a conversation with a the guy who helped me to get my website, Guerrilla Media, up and running in the first place. And you have a look at Guerrilla Media and it looks like shit. And the reason it looks like shit is because the guy who helped me to do it was a slave in the mind. He decided that it wasn't worth it helping out with the website anymore. It wasn't worth it, that he would much rather work for some company and make money there and keep his head down in order to avoid the coming New World Order or whatever, as he believed in Doomsday, rather than help me expose Scumbaggery and have a better platform for which to let people's voices be heard, kind of thing. And he's like, oh, you're just a slave, Vinny, you're just a slave. And I say, well, I'll tell you what, man, you're a hell of a lot more of a slave than I am, because it really is a state of mind. If I have the state of mind, I'm a slave, there's nothing I can do, and then I choose to do nothing, then I truly am a slave. If I'm a slave...
And I agree with that.
If I'm a slave right now, and I believe I'm still a slave right now, but the difference between me and, say, him, is that I don't want to be a slave, and I will fight for my freedom. I won't give in. That makes me, mentally, not a slave.
Well, just to finish the thing, yeah, I agree with you, is that a cat and a dog doesn't know what money is, doesn't know what being purchased or sold is. It doesn't have any relative understanding of what being a slave might be. It just knows it's comfortable. It knows it's loved. It's know that it's being taken care of. And no one would rise up from that, you know?
Did you ever see the George Orwell's Animal Farm, the cartoon version? I think it was like after the animals.
That was produced by the CIA,
as they say, and written by George Orwell, of course. And there was a scene in it just after the animals had had a revolution on the farm and kicked out the farmer. These birds were sent out in every direction to tell other animals about how much of a success Animal Farm had been, i.e., communism. And it says in the film that the animals, like cats who are sitting out on this porch, you know, drinking its beautiful, nice, warm saucer of milk and everything like that, would listen to the bird for a second and then reject him and say, go away, I don't care, because they have it really comfortable. But the animals who were, a bullock in the field, ploughing really, really hard every day and being whipped, listened very, very intently and accepted everything that the bird had to say about Animal Farm. And my conclusion is about life in general is that unless you suffer, you don't grow and you're not willing to listen. Really. The more comfortable we have it, the weaker we are and the more enslaved we are.
Yeah, I think these are all excellent points. I just want to quickly... say, I mean, David made a reference here to Look at All the Happy Creatures, which is a book I wrote, which is sort of like an Animal Farm type deal, where it's about animals that are in horrible conditions and are trying to revolt from this situation. And I think this is ultimately something that is very, very near and dear to my heart. I just want to throw out two things, is to say not everything is a purchased situation also. The cat that I have was an animal rescue, an animal that was going to be put to death that I rescued and welcomed into my home when I was, it was at a time when I was so broke, I wasn't sure how I was feeding myself, and I took in this other life form to help feed it. I don't see that as me taking upon ownership of an animal that's doing my best to, hey, I don't have it great, but if you want to at least live, you know, come live with me.
But what if somebody stole your cat? And you wanted it, and you wanted it back. Let's say, for example, would you say that's my cat to this person? Give it back to me.
I guess it depends what the circumstance. If someone came into my house and removed my cat without, my I mean, just the whole circumstance of someone coming into my house to do anything. What is this circumstance? So,
well, not well. Like, let's say your cat's on the street. Somebody picks him up and starts walking away with your cat.
Right. Just to say, like, my cat's an indoor cat. My friend Doug had an outdoor cat, and at some point, his cat was hanging out on his neighbor's porch for like pretty regularly. And at some point, those people moved. And they brought that cat with them. And at first he was upset, like, oh my God, they just took my cat. And he was like, well, actually, I guess it wasn't really my cat. You know, it's like that cat came here and I fed it sometimes. But he felt like a little like a jilted lover, you know, like, hey, they chose someone else over me. I think that's probably under those sort of circumstances, you might be like upset of like, oh, I really enjoyed that cat's company. That's a shame. Is completely different than, again, if someone came like into my home and, you know, removed anything from my home, I would be pretty upset for a completely different reason than...
Well, it's about the appliance of ownership. Like, again, if he actually had the phone number of those people to the new house that they moved in and he knew that they had the cat, would he have called them and say, hey, can I have my cat back? Or did he just accept that he'd lost the cat because he knew that he didn't know their number and he wouldn't be able to get it back unless he hired some kind of private investigator and just thought it wasn't worth the effort?
I think he called them and said, hey, did you notice, you know, what happened after you guys moved? What happened to the cat that always hung out on your front porch? And they're like, oh, we didn't know that was your cat. And I think they gave it to someone else, like an adoption thing or whatever they did with it. And he was like, oh, okay, at least, you know, the cat's taken care of. He didn't make an issue out of it. And
can you imagine a dude in like New York who had a cat named Django and the cat went missing and they put a sign up on a telephone pole and it said, have you seen my cat Django? Please call me, return to me. Right. I don't know. I'm spinning off on a tangent there.
I have a good friend who had a pet raccoon. And the raccoon got away. He took care of it. He found the raccoon was dying when it was very small. And he took it in. He nursed it. He did the whole thing, you know, not physically with his breast or anything. But he took care of this raccoon. It was a total tame raccoon. It got away. He had to put up signs all over the town for his raccoon. And a couple months later, or somewhere in there, a while later, he gets a call from an old woman who had taken in the raccoon. So the raccoon came to her porch and wasn't like the other raccoon. She was feeding it. It was in her house. He came over to see if it was, and sure enough, it was his raccoon, and he saw how much she loved it, and he said, you know what, keep the raccoon, whatever.
But, you need this one more than I do. I think it's compassion. When I think that's what really separates us from the animals, and maybe we infect animals with that, is just compassion for other species and other people, empathy, that kind of thing. I'm not 100% sure if there's instances of animals really either going out of their way and doing things that are against maybe natural law of nature type programming, where they will, I don't know, a lion will try to eat a baby wildebeest or something like that, and then he's chewing on its leg and the thing's crying, and he sees the wildebeest's mother, you know, getting really stressed out, and he goes, you know what, I'm sorry, you know, just dust him off, go back to your mother, I'm sorry, you know. I don't think that happens.
What was I thinking?
You know, in human society, it happens all the time. People will start doing something really, really bad, and then they'll see the consequences of their actions that other people are feeling, and they'll stop what they're doing, and they'll change their entire direction because of how somebody else feels, not because of how they feel.
Yeah.
It speaks well of us, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there are cases like, you guys remember like Coco's Kitten or something, like the gorilla that had a kitten and things like that. You remember that from the 80s? Mm. Anyway, but yeah, there's all sorts of different examples. And thank you. I'm glad someone gets my obscure references. But I think there are definitely things like, even like I had pet rats when I took in this kitten, and the idea was that if the kitten was under a certain age, then it would learn to coexist with the rodents. And if it was over a certain age, it was basically hopeless. I had done some research. And when I adopted the kitten, it was already a few weeks past that. And I tried to get them to coexist, and it didn't work. But there is something, again, this is where instinct takes over. If you can, and is that, which is more wrong? Do I try and, short circuit? If I get a kitten at a young enough age, I can say, hey, actually, you don't kill these other things.
Well, it's like the Jesuits. It's like the Jesuits who give me a boy until the age of 7 and I'll show you the man, give me a kitten until the age of 6 weeks or something and I'll show you the cat.
Yeah.